is, I have to say that William Catton is, how many people in here have read Overshoot? Okay, homework assignment for everybody who doesn't have a hand up. I think everybody needs to read that book. It's fundamental, it's foundational to any understanding of what's physically going on, both with the economy and with the natural world. It's, well, why don't you give a one sentence, before we go to the real interview, like a one sentence summary of Overshoot.
If I could have done that a number of years ago, it would have saved a lot of trouble writing the book. But the problem that I'm pointing to in that is that we've greatly surpassed the carrying capacity of the planet for our species. And we're in trouble because a world in which there's a carrying capacity deficit is fantastically different from a world in which there was a carrying capacity surplus. That's one sentence.
And one, put a semicolon. And then,
okay.
And then can you, for the people who don't know, and then before we start, can you define carrying capacity? Unless you're
carrying capacity is the maximum load that an ecosystem can support indefinitely, or more or less permanently, in other words. We can surpass carrying capacity briefly, but not permanently. And when we surpass it, we're in trouble.
So, this is William Catton. Okay, go ahead. Okay, so the first, we're gonna ask several questions together. First one is, do you think that the economic recession ended more than a year ago, as economists have?
No.
Why not, and why would they have said so? What if it becomes a double-dip recession? Do present economic troubles have important ecological implications that earlier hard times perhaps would not have had? And finally, for now, will there soon be real economic recovery from this most recent economic recession?
And the answer to that, of course, again, is no. I should begin by saying that some of my best relatives are economists. But I think the problem with the economic view of the recession is perhaps epitomized by a statement by the guy in Wisconsin who is running to unseat Russ Feingold from the Senate, Ron Johnson, I think is his name, and he said that we are committing intergenerational larceny. Okay, that's a good term, intergenerational larceny. We're stealing from future generations. But he had it in mind simply in monetary terms, that we've got to get the deficit down and so on. If people would start thinking in terms of an ecological deficit instead of a monetary deficit, we'd be a lot closer to understanding what our real predicament is. We are committing intergenerational larceny in terms of what we're doing to the planet. Now, this picture we've had up here all this time should be very familiar to you. This is one of the oil platforms in the Gulf of Mexico, and we learned a lot about that in this past summer and spring. But most people, I think, did not really focus on the real problem there. What are we doing as a species, having to go after a resource that we say we need, that is becoming elusive enough so that we have to drill, first of all, a whole mile down into the water, and then drill another mile into the ground underneath that water? When we first started the oil industry, we started having gushers every once in a while. And when you struck a gusher, that was supposed to be a good thing, lots of oil there. And the pressure of the gas in the ground was pushing it out. We should have expected that when you drill underwater, you're going to every once in a while have a gusher. We had a real gusher there in the Gulf of Mexico. And what we've got to learn is that the human species really has no right to punch holes in the bottom of the ocean like that. Now, if I can remember which button to push here. Here's the picture of the oil production, as it's called, in the United States, from the the start up to the present time there over at the right. And the point that I want to make here, first of all, is simply notice we're on the downslope. This is annual U.S. oil production. Production is a bad term there. It should be extraction. Humans didn't produce that stuff. Nature produced it millions of years ago, deposited it safely underground where we couldn't reach it. Well, now we've learned how to reach it, and that's why we're in trouble. But the fact that we're on the downslope means that life henceforth is going to be different from what life was like when we were on the upslope there. A fact of life is that any organism and any population has to use the environment in three ways. Any organism has to use the environment as a source of sustenance, also as the space in which it does its various activities, and as a disposal site, because we all produce something in the process of living that we want to get rid of. Now, in an overloaded world, this becomes a sad fact, SAD there, source, activity, disposal. I'm glad I was born in an English-speaking country because the acronym doesn't work in other languages. Why is it a sad fact in an overloaded world? Because it's impossible any longer to segregate each of those uses from the other two. And so we're in trouble because of the fact that the three different uses interfere with each other. You got more questions?
Yeah, I'm just thinking about that.
There's more to come.
Okay, this question seems pretty embarrassing, really. But given public discourse, I think it needs to be asked. Does a finite Earth necessarily, and especially since some of your friends or relatives are economists, does a finite Earth necessarily have ecological limits? What would you say are the most essential ideas people need to know in order to understand present and future circumstances, and why are such ideas not widely enough known, or why are they disregarded?
Not enough people have taken courses in ecology. That's the answer to the last question, I guess. Or not enough people have read Overshoot. I was pleased to see quite a number of hands go up in here, but I did notice that there were a lot more people that didn't raise their hand than did. So, but seriously, a finite Earth necessarily does have ecological limits. If you think about it, just open your mind a little bit and think, how is it that we have imagined that we could go on increasing our numbers on a finite planet forever? And if we just are not worried at all about overdoing it, this implies that we're thinking that it could go on forever. It can't go on forever. I hope I haven't lost that. There we go. This is the axiomatic statement that I think provides the basis for answering that series of questions. For any kind of use of any particular environment by any species, there's a rate or amount of such use that can be exceeded only by reducing the subsequent suitability of that environment for that use. If you stay below that level, then things could go on and on and on and on. But if you exceed that level, you begin to destroy the habitat upon which you're dependent. And this is true for all species. There can be too many of any particular species. But ecologically speaking, the interactions between the different species have tended to keep each other in some kind of balance until Homo sapiens came along and learned ways of evading those limits. So we need a good definition of carrying capacity. I began by defining it as simply the maximum sustainable load, but let's get a little more explicit here. For ranchers and range managers, carrying capacity has been a familiar term for several generations. The maximum population of a given species, obviously different species will have different carrying capacities. Maximum population of a given species that a particular environment can support indefinitely, and that word indefinitely is important there. You can exceed carrying capacity temporarily, but not permanently. What does indefinitely refer to there? It means the maximum load that can be supported without habitat damage. If you exceed the carrying capacity, you begin damaging the habitat. Now, we humans are a very special species. Special in the sense that we're the only species that could get together like this and talk. So, in the case of humans, human carrying capacity is the maximum human population equipped with a given assortment of technology and a given pattern of organization that a particular environment can support indefinitely. And by indefinitely, we still mean without habitat damage. We're the only species that has any extensive technology outside our own bodies. Darwin was fascinated by the fact that the different species of birds on the different Galapagos Islands had different shaped beaks for using different resources on the different islands. Well, their technology was part of their bodies. Humans have a lot of exosomatic technology, and so it's as if humans were really not just one species, but many species. That's why we have to have that, what I've got in blue letters there, equipped with a given assortment of technology and a given pattern of organization. And so different human societies, in effect, have different carrying capacities. They can do different things to the environment that may result in habitat damage if they do too much of it. Things have changed through time. The earliest human beings gathered naturally available and mainly renewable sustenance materials. They were hunters and gatherers. There were very few of them compared to the present human population of the planet. They were foragers, like all previous animal species had been. All other species are foragers. Humans can be something more. About 10,000 years ago, we made a big change by inventing processes that we call agriculture. Homo sapiens began managing ecosystems to ensure that more of what we wanted would be produced, and that meant less of some of the things that other species would have been foraging for. And so the advent of farming there meant that we had a different relationship to the ecosystem than we'd ever had before. We could sustainably have available the things that we needed because we were managing the system. Now, about 200 years ago, a little over 200 years ago, we made another breakthrough that was a disaster. We're discovering finally that it was a disaster. We became Homo colossus, not just Homo sapiens, because we began to use the fossil fuels to provide additional amounts of energy. Human beings had long been using energy from sources other than their own muscles. They used the muscles of other animals that they domesticated. And they used wind power to some extent, and they used moving water as a source of energy. But a couple hundred years ago, we began using fossil fuel energy. The very fact that we defined the stuff underground that was carbon rich as fuels because it would burn and could release energy, that was, in retrospect, we can say that was our blunder. So we became Homo colossus. What we need to realize now, and people just have not recognized this fact, is that that made us revert to being foragers. We'd made a great step forward by advancing from foraging to farming. Now we made a tremendous leap backwards in advancing to foraging again. And that's why I had that picture of the oil derrick out there in the ocean on the screen for so long, because what we're now hell-bent on doing is depleting exhaustible supplies of substances that we have come to depend upon and need very desperately. So let's illustrate that with a slightly different way here with some pictures. Foraging means gathering the stuff that nature made available. Farming means we do the production of the stuff, and foraging again on a super scale now. That's the situation that we've committed ourselves to. Now, part of the danger is we've made ourselves too dependent upon specific resources, and in this particular case, they were resources that are non-renewable on any kind of human scale. But even if we're talking about renewable resources, we can use them faster than their rate of renewal, or there can be other factors that make them not renewable. they begin to be destroyed. This is the population experience of Ireland over a period of time. Back in 1739, there was a big freeze that killed a lot of the potato crop, and a lot of Irish people starved, so the curve drops down a little bit right back there early on. But then it took off again, and they've had successful potato crops for a number of years, and the population increased madly. And whereas you had started only right slightly above 2 million people in Ireland when the takeoff began, it got up well over 8 million. That's too many people for that size land mass. And they had also become, for various historic reasons that we need not go into here, that the economists went into, they'd become dependent upon the potato as a mainstay of their sustenance. Well, then a fungus invaded the island and began destroying the potato crop. And so the population curve has to drop sharply down. Happily, in those days, there was still surplus carrying capacity elsewhere on the planet. And so a lot of Irish came to North America, for one thing. But there were a couple million who met premature death from starvation and other diseases. But notice that the curve is starting to bend slightly back upward there as we approach present time over there. So the Irish are not necessarily out of the woods yet. You have some more questions?
On a finite planet, why is the American traditional expectation of continuing growth and perpetual progress seem so plausible to so many people? Has that plausibility been eroded? And what has changed in our time to erode the conviction that perpetual growth is possible and desirable?
I think we got the impression of potential growth simply because early on there really was a carrying capacity surplus for the kinds of use of the total environment that human beings were capable of doing. Then that plausibility of perpetual growth was aggravated when Europeans discovered that there was a whole second hemisphere. These two continents in the Western world seemed so enticing. They were very sparsely populated relatively to, in comparison to Europe, by the Indians who were here. And they didn't count, of course, because they weren't Europeans. And so we started taking over the second hemisphere. And then that was perhaps reinforced a little bit further with a slightly later discovery of Australia and New Zealand and some Pacific islands and so on. But you can't go on discovering second hemispheres very long. There was only one real second hemisphere. Anyway, that's what made it plausible. Now, the population density of the second hemisphere is greater than the population density of the first hemisphere was at the time of the discovery. Moreover, we have become, with all of this technological equipment that we've invented in the last couple of hundred years, a much larger species than we used to be. We're more numerous, we're also much larger than we used to be. And so we've made ourselves dependent upon non-renewable resources with a vengeance, and we've made ourselves dependent on vast quantities of the non-renewable resource. And that's why the plausibility has ceased to be. Saying that to go back to the first batch of questions there, that this recession was caused by the loss of carrying capacity. What I'm saying is that this recession has got to be different from previous recessions because it's occurring in a time when we've lost carrying capacity. And a recession in a time when you're facing a carrying capacity deficit is bound to have a different outcome from an earlier recession that occurred when we could still plausibly think of having a carrying capacity surplus. If you read Paul Krugman in the New York Times, recently he's in a number of columns, he's deplored the fact that we didn't spend enough on the, what's it called? The
stimulus
program. I needed more of a stimulus to think of that term. He thinks that we needed a bigger stimulus and that we've made the same mistake that he thinks FDR made after the end of his first term, when by that time people were urging him to get off of this deficit spending and so on. And so he did kind of retract a little bit. And he's suggesting that Obama today is facing the same predicament that FDR faced about 1937, beginning of his second term. Well, we're not in 1937 or 38 anymore. And so let's go to one more version of this. Now, that's 1938 there, the boundary between the white and the red under the curve there. To the left of that boundary, that's all the oil that Americans had ever extracted from underneath American territory from the beginning of the oil industry up to 1938. The part I've colored in red there is what we've extracted since then. And that's a hell of a lot of oil that we pumped out of the ground. And we're on the downslope, as I say. We're not discovering new deposits anywhere near as fast as we're exhausting old deposits. And so Obama, trying to stimulate the economy, doesn't face the opportunities for stimulating it that FDR faced back in 1937-38. Now, to enable you to visualize that quantitatively, think of an oil drum, you know, about this big around, about that tall, barrel of oil, 42 gallons. Now think of 10 of those lined up here. Now think of 10 rows like that, 100. Now think of 10 of those 10 by 10 row blocks of oil barrels, 100. And then think of that 100 deep. Now think of tenfold that, so that you've got 1,000 by 1,000 barrels of oil. That doesn't begin to be this much oil. Now think of stacking up 1,000 by 1,000 blocks of 42-gallon barrels, 1,000 high. Think of that great big cube block of oil barrels. Okay, now think of 180 of those cubes of blocks of 1,000 by 1,000 by 1,000. That's how much oil is under that red curve there. That's how much isn't in the ground anymore for us to go after, because we've already got it out and used it up. That's where we are now. That's why some of the things that once were plausible aren't plausible anymore.
So will ecological limits differently affect people in different parts of the world? And if so, what factors will differentiate the impacts on these different people? And why can't we count on technological progress to save us from ecological disaster? Further ecological disaster.
Different parts of the world will be affected differently by the ecological deficit that the world now confronts, because different parts of the world are using their local part of the world differently. Now, the terminology that we've invented to refer to these different parts of the world has not really been adequate. When I was a kid, first studying history as a grade schooler and then in high school, we talked about the advanced countries and the backward countries. Later, we outgrew that ethnocentric language, and we started talking about developed and underdeveloped countries. Then we decided that even underdeveloped was kind of a stigma that was not quite proper. And so we started talking about developed and developing countries. What we really should have been talking about was countries that are populated by Homo colossus, that is the technologically advanced, fossil fuel ravenous, non-renewable resource ravenous countries, and the countries that haven't yet committed themselves nearly so fully to depending upon exhaustible resources. That's the real difference. And if you divide the world into countries that are on one side of a development line and those that are on another side of a development line, obviously they will be affected differently. But the assumption that we tend to make on our side of the line, that we are going to survive the problems that come better than the people on the wrong side of the line, may be exactly the reverse of the truth. It may very well be that the countries that have not yet committed themselves to a ravenous use of non-renewable resources will end up better off in the long run than those of us that have made that advance. Now, I think you were about going to ask me next whether there's a way out of this.
Well, is there a way out of this?
I hope so. Let me suggest, this may be a little bit fanciful. My favorite sentence in the English language, I told you a few minutes ago that I was glad to have been born in the English-speaking world because of the sad acronym there. It doesn't work in other languages. I found that even the word overshoot doesn't occur in other languages. Overshoot has been translated into Russian, and recently a Spanish language edition has come out, and neither language had the equivalent to the word overshoot. I don't know what the word was in Russian that they made do with it, but they talked about the collapse of the techno economy or something like that. And the Spanish word is rebasados, which I guess simply means excesses. Well, that's pretty close to overshoot. We did have a chance to see that this was the problem a long time ago. My favorite sentence in the English language is the last sentence on this bronze plaque. Most of you can't read it because it's down the bottom here. This is a plaque commemorating the first director of the National Park Service, Stephen Ting Mather, who the Park Service was founded in 1916. And there's a plaque like this in every one of our national parks. And it says at the bottom there, he laid the foundation of the National Park Service, defining and establishing the policies under which its areas shall be developed and conserved unimpaired for future generations. That's the key idea. Conserved unimpaired for future generations. That's awfully close to recognizing the carrying capacity concept. Then my favorite sentence, there will never come an end to the good that he has done. I hope that's true. What a fantastic sentence that is. There's only one word of more than one syllable in it. There will never come an end, never is the two-syllable word, never come an end to the good that he has done. Recently, I've begun wondering, there will never come an end to the harm that some people have done. And not that I'm saying that we could make the whole world a national park, but we needed to approach our use of the planet in somewhat the same mood as we were approaching, as he was approaching the national parks. We wanted to preserve them unimpaired for future generations. And I would hope that my great-grandsons, two of whom I have, are going to have a world that they can still enjoy. But it's not going to be the same world in which I was a little kid.
So did you want to use that as the end, or did you want to go with the last question? That sort of answers in some ways. Is it possible that humanity's future has been irreparably damaged?
Well, it may be. And in terms of what this conference is about, where we're trying to mount a real protest movement to just bring to a halt the devastation that we've been committing on this planet, I think we've got to remember what a multidimensional onslaught it has been. There are three aspects to it, and just tackling any one of them isn't going to do the job. Somehow, we have got to end population growth because there's too many of us already. Even if we weren't using it as on a per capita ravenous basis as much as we are. We've also got to stop our technological enlargement of the per capita appetites for the stuff that the planet consists of. And then we've got to recognize the fact that we have extended our impact. We no longer, when I drive my car and emit CO2 into the atmosphere, or when I breathe and emit a little bit of CO2 into the atmosphere, it isn't just the atmosphere over me that is going to change in such a way that it no longer does the protection that I need from carcinogenic ultraviolet rays. It's the atmosphere over the whole world. We've extended our impact on the planet. We're no longer just local beings. So we've got all three of those things. That has diminished our independence. And so even though we are kind of impelled by the fact that we all have a job, we hope, and we have to earn an income and so on, we're impelled to give priority to our own individual needs, regardless of the planet, we can no longer get away with doing that. Life is not that simple anymore. But what worries me is that we may, in our quest to devise a way of stopping all three of those development processes, we may become misanthropes. And so I'd like to go back to the thoughts of an English clergyman several centuries ago, John Donne, who said, "No man is an island, every man is a piece of a continent." And please remember, in those days, men and women, all humans are pieces of humanity. And what we need to worry about is, can we change humanity's aspirations to make them less habitat destructive without ourselves becoming misanthropic in the process? We need a sense of modesty. To go back to the national park example, let me conclude again with a nice motto. I think maybe it's the Wilderness Society that has come up with this. But when you enter a national park, take only pictures. Don't take the stuff out of the park. Take only pictures, leave only footprints. Somehow we need the equivalent of that motto in our approach to life on this planet. I will retreat to the book department out there.
Okay. We're going to take 5 minutes for pee break or to have him sign his book or whatever, and then we'll be back in a couple minutes.
I'm looking for that.
I mean, I worry so much.